also from Omaha. I want to make sure everybody understands that when you present your arguments today, this is being live streamed across the state. So if you have any sensitive issues or any sensitive material, you might want to simply use the first name of the parties that we're referring to as opposed to the full names. Also, I understand that there has been an agreement by council that the Hawks case may go first. That's fine with us. And so we'll call the first case. When I call the case, I'll ask you to come forward, and then I will call it a second time for purposes of recording. And with that, we'll call State versus Hawks. The first case today is State versus Hawks. Good morning, Mr. Krieger.
May it please the court. My name is Bob Krieger. I represent Jeff Hawks. Just a point of clarification. In the brief, we used the initials of the alleged victims in these cases. The typographical errors to the victim in count, first count in 387, it's not really material to our discussion here today, but I think he's referred to as AF instead of AH, but that's the victim in one first count. This is a consolidated appeal because these two cases in which it was charged that Mr. Hawks had inappropriate sexual contact with minors under the 14 years of age or under, although separately charged, were consolidated for trial, and the court then, under Rule 414, admitted the testimony of an uncharged victim, and he was TW, referred to in the brief. We objected to the consolidation, and we objected to the Rule 414 evidence for the reasons clearly set forth in the record. I know the legislature has kind of, if not actually trumped the entire argument by allowing what historically we had disallowed as unduly prejudicial, and that is the aggregation of these offenses charged separately into one trial. I'm not going to talk much about that the issue of the consolidation and the 414 material I've set forth in my brief, but I will talk about the prejudice that resulted from that when we get to the primary issue that I want to talk about on the appeal, and that is the sufficiency of the evidence to support the charge in 16388, and that involves the victim identified as AW. We will, in connection with that discussion, discuss how or why there is error in the consolidation and how the Rule 414 evidence may have adversely affected the verdict in that case. First, I'll argue that the evidence was insufficient to support the verdict in the AW case for a very significant reason. The material elements of the offense charge required that the contact take place when the victim was 14 years of age or under. Relevant to this appeal, the facts are as follows. The case in 387 became public, and there was news accounts of it, and during those news accounts, AW came forward to his parents and discussed the fact that he may have been touched inappropriately by the defendant during the time period after he had coached Little League. I'm not going to get into all of the details. The historical facts are in the briefs. But he was a Me Too guy. And when he went to law enforcement, was interviewed, he was interviewed at the Project Harmony interview, and law enforcement, together with the social workers and caseworkers, sought to determine when this happened, because it was not a fresh complaint, it was not a timely complaint, it was a complaint that arose solely from the news account. And he told the authorities at the time he didn't remember when it happened. And they tried to reconstruct timelines, and they tried to refresh his recollection with events and other circumstances. And during his initial Project Harmony interview, he said, "I do remember, however, that it was related to a very specific event, an event in which Mr. Hawks, who was an invited guest of the family at his home, came over to pick up some sports equipment that his father had found that Mr. Hawks had left behind at a facility where he taught Little League." So he wasn't able to tell us when that was, but he was able to quite specifically state that was the event, that was one of the triggering circumstances during which one of these touching episodes took place. So as the case progressed and we tried to figure out when this occurred, we took his deposition, and prior to trial, he reviewed his reports, he reviewed his Project Harmony interview, and he testified under oath, yes, that's when it happened. It happened when Mr. Hawks came over to my house and picked up some sports equipment from my father. We went up into the bedroom, and some bad things happened. So as the trial progresses and, excuse me, as the discovery progresses and the trial progresses, Mr. W., his father, and Mr. Hawks start reviewing email and other contemporaneous records and discovered that the email thread in which Mr. Hawks was told there was sports equipment at the house, come over and picked it up, established that that took place in late December of 2014. Now, what's significant about that date is we found out when that was. We found out when the event happened by reference to undisputed testimonial and digital evidence in which the trial testimony was clear and Mr. W.'s father was clear. They could identify the date by the time of trial. However, at the trial date, by the time the trial came around, A.W. completely changed his statement. Says, no, that's not when it happened. It happened sometime after my 12-year-old season, but before I turned 15. Still no specific date, just it just happened some other time.
Before he turned 15 or before he turned 14?
I think it was before he turned 50. Because I think 14, he's still under, it's 14 or younger, so I think he's an eligible victim under the statute until he turns 50. But once he attains the age of 15, this offense doesn't apply to him. There may be other offenses that are applicable, but not this one. So he was confronted at trial with this. He attested to his sworn testimony. He said, yes, this is what I said under oath. This is what I told the Project Harmony people. But something happened, unexplained, in which all of that went away, and now that's not when it happens. And in the context of this case, that was critical because all of the 412, the joinder, the 414 evidence, all related to the common claim that this happened when they were 12, 13, while he was being coached. Well, this incident turns out to not be that at all. This incident turns out to be something when he's in high school or playing football and older than 14. And so the trial court was, at the close of the evidence, at least on this charge, I moved to dismiss on the insufficiency of the evidence. I argued that no rational juror could conclude from his own sworn testimony which one to believe. It wasn't credibility against other evidence. It was credibility based upon his own change in sworn testimony.
But isn't that a question for the jury?
Not in my opinion, and that's why I'm here. I believe that when that happens in a criminal case like this, where it's not just a subtle fact or a collateral fact, where it is a material element of the crime charge, in this case his age, that if this is his sworn position going into the case, it defies credulity to think he can change that testimony just because he finds out that it occurred when he was older. And that's the problem in this case.
But in these kind of cases, aren't you going to have that kind of situation just because of the age of the witnesses and the fact that it's hard to sometimes keep it all straight?
No, not like I've been doing this for 40 years. I get that they might change a circumstance, or they may learn more, but he volunteered this. This was his position. He said this is when it happened. And he never explained, and the state didn't try to explain, why all of a sudden, no, that's not when it happened, and repudiates it. It's not that it just, oh, well, it was some other date. He still never tells us when it happened. The only testimony he's given under oath and the only testimony that he gave to Project Harmony was, this is the day it happened. And
it happened multiple times, did it
but
not?
But by his own account, it happened within a 30-day period. And all 30 of those days is after he's 15. And so whether the judge should have ever submitted this case to the jury, I say not. Whether this is a... And we have this issue that I briefed this discussion about. In a civil case, he couldn't get away with this. He couldn't testify seeking money, that it was one way until he finds out that the facts prove he has no claim, and so he changes his testimony. We never tolerate that in a civil case. And to think we would tolerate that in a criminal case where the victim quite clearly, the inference is clear, it's okay for him to say that this happened when I was 12. I was a young, small, skinny kid. And if you listen to the testimony, most of these so-called episodes that he testified to were consensual encounters. in experimenting with homosexual sex at the age of 15. Not saying that's a just, I'm just simply saying, for him to suddenly have to realize that this didn't happen, or tell people it didn't happen when he was 12, but it happened when he was 15, I think that's the motivating factor for him to change that testimony in the course of the trial. So whether it's under the standard that I believe it should be, this testimony should be discredited as a matter of law, and the jury shouldn't get to decide it. But let's assume that it is. I think it's quite clear he would have had a better chance in front of a jury on this case if it didn't also involve the 414 and the 404 evidence of the victim in count 387. In other words, it wasn't a fair fight. Any trial lawyer would love to argue a case to a jury where the victim has repudiated an important element of the case standing on its own. Reasonable doubt is self-evident. But when you aggregate it all together, you join them and you squeeze them together, the jury did not give Mr. Hawks a fair chance to argue that point to the jury. The conviction in count, the second count, actually manifests what I think is the prejudice in the jointer. So I'm out of time, and I thank you for accommodating my jury schedule this morning.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
May it please the court, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. Your Honors, it's precisely because this is a material element that it's a jury question. A.W., repeatedly said he wasn't entirely sure of the exact dates that these events occurred, and as you know, time flows differently for children. That's why we have the rather extraordinary statute of limitations with sexual offenses that result in the abuse of children. He said, however, that he did know that the events started in January 2012 and they ended before the start of baseball season in 2012, which was in April of that year. So we've got the time frame nailed down. Yes, there were other time frames testified to. That was all presented to the jury, which chose to believe A.W.'s testimony that it was in the early part of 2012 that these events happened. It's a jury question. It was presented to them. Contradictory testimony was also presented to them. The jury made its choice based on the facts presented to it, and there were adequate facts to present to the jury for them to make that decision. Your Honors, that's simply just a common event that happens in almost every jury trial ever presented to a jury. You have somebody saying A, you have somebody saying B, the jury says, okay, based on what we see and hear, we have chosen to believe A. And
you don't have a lot of experience, though, of having a witness, the victim, defendant in a civil case, a victim in a criminal case, say that it's between these dates and then some point later on completely change the testimony. That's not usual.
With children, it's not that uncommon because time just moves differently for children. You know, a month to a 12-year-old is a whole lot different than a month to, say, somebody our age. A month is like that to us. To them, it's an eternity.
Does the record reflect that what you claim is different for children? I mean, did you have an expert testify it's different for children?
In this particular case, no. But, I mean, there are cases, and I don't have them cited in my brief. It's just, there are cases out there that, and I think actually if you go back through the legislative history for when they started to expand the statutes of limitations to create these wide gaps in the statute of limitations for child abuse cases, it's precisely because that. The kids are reluctant to come forward because a lot of them don't completely understand what had happened to them and the seriousness of it, and they can't put a date or a time on it. You know, they can say it happened when I was going to, you know, X elementary school. When within that time frame, I don't know. I just remember I was in the third grade at X school. And that's how their frame of reference is different, essentially, is what is driving a lot of these things. And he was 12 years old when this happened. A 12-year-old still has a different frame of reference than, say, a 16-year-old. And I think that because that the jury was presented with the evidence that it happened during the time frame when he testified when he was 12, just under 13 years old, I think. The jury chose that version of events to believe and found the defendant guilty.
How are we to come to that conclusion that a 12-year-old has a different frame of reference from this record?
Well, I think the fact that there are different time frames and the fact that he said, I was never entirely sure of the exact dates when this happened. You know, I can place it between this and this, but, you know, beyond that, I can't give you an exact date. If somebody, 25, 30-year-old, this happened to them, they would probably be, they'd be able to give you time, date, location, you know, extraordinary. It's just, it's part of being a kid. Time isn't that important to you.
In this case, is it compounded because you not only have the victim changing his story, but then you've had the consolidation of the trial and you've got the admission of the 414? I mean, is that a problem when all of those are strung together?
No, I don't think so. There were extensive hearings on each of those particular issues, and frankly, none of the issues are that unique in a child sexual abuse case. Frequently, there are multiple victims, as there were in this particular case, and frequently, a child predator has a particular profile of a victim. In this case, they were fairly pre-adolescent boys. He had access to them because of his baseball coaching position. The 414 evidence was properly admitted. 414 was designed to be propensity evidence, and that's exactly what it shows in this particular case. The joinder of the two cases simply was properly done because of the factual similarities between the case. He had access to them because of his baseball coaching position. The boys were a very similar age. The type of contact was quite similar. They had a hearing in front of Judge Merritt, I believe it was, to join the two cases, and after hearing all the evidence, the judge made rather specific and lengthy factual findings saying, yes, I find these cases are appropriately joined because they are so factually similar. So no, I don't think there's any error in either the joinder or the admission of the 414 evidence in this case. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the judgment and sentences be affirmed in this case.
Question. Thank you very much. You may step back. Counselor excused. Matter is deemed submitted. The next matter before the court is Smith versus Sarpy County.